Current State.
Welcome to Current State. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association, sitting in for Mark Bayshore. On the program today, post-jail suicide prevention with a noted MSU professor. We'll learn about something called the LoonCast with two of its providers, discuss the discovery of water on the planet Mars, visit with two people from the Mid-Michigan Diaper Bank, and hear Scott Pohl's conversation with football star and rising country music singer Riley Bulla. First, nearly 12 million people pass through America's jails each year, and it's believed that more than half suffer from some type of mental illness. The time between a detainee's release from jail and their court appearance is often when they're most vulnerable. Research suggests released persons are four times more likely to attempt suicide than those in jail. An MSU clinical professor is leading a study aimed at stopping post-detention suicides. Dr. Jennifer Johnson joins us to talk about her research. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you so much.
What made you decide to do this in the first place?
Well, so my research has been a lot about finding better treatments for mental health and substance use problems for people involved in the justice system. And 2 years ago, the National Institute of Mental Health came to me and my other principal investigator, who's at Brown, and said, you know, we're trying to do population-level suicide prevention. About half of folks who commit suicide aren't in mental health treatment at the time they die. And we've looked at where they are, and it turns out one of the answers to that is they're in the justice system. What can you do for us for treatments for folks at risk for suicide in the justice system?
Why are released persons more likely to take their lives?
Jail, just to start with, collects folks at risk for a lot of things, including mental health and substance use problems. Usually when you're arrested, it's not the happiest moment in your life. Usually things are going wrong. In jail, you know, some people do commit suicide, but the jails watch them pretty closely. But once they're released into the community, there's nobody watching them. They may have access to guns, cars, pills, they're just set loose with no supervision.
How did this study come together? Was this an interest you've always wanted to pursue?
You know, I have always been really interested in mental health and substance use care for vulnerable populations. People living in poverty are more likely to have problems with mental health. Pregnant women have problems with mental health. I do treatment research for them. But I went into a women's prison 10 years ago, and I saw, you know, at the time I was 30-ish, and I saw rooms full of women in their 20s and 30s. You know, they looked a lot like me. A lot of them were moms. And I just thought, you know, for one twist of fate, this could be me or this could have been me. So many of them are victims of physical and sexual violence, have mental health problems, addiction, and the current system does the best it can but is limited in treatment resources. So, you know, that ended up being the focus of my research for the next 10 years is trying to figure out how to improve mental health care in particular for justice-involved folks.
Right now, what is the mental health status of the 12 million people who pass through the jail systems all over the country?
Well, like I said, you know, more than half have mental health problems. About two-thirds have addiction. And the jails have a really tough job. You know, when I just moved to Michigan, so I was friends with the head of the mental health services for the Department of Corrections in another state. And he explained, you know, we could get 300 admissions into the jail in a weekend. Jail and the police is who you call when you don't know what to do with someone when they're belligerent or high or psychotic or wandering the park at night not making sense. And so they end up, you know, like I said, getting 300 folks, all of whom, many of whom were often in crisis, and they may only have them a couple days before they're released. You know, most jails have maybe one or two full-time social workers, so they're working even to just assess everyone before they get in, much less provide any treatment or refer to services in the community. It's just very difficult. They just don't have the resources to do it.
Too short of a time and just not enough people.
Correct.
You're based in Flint, so you're working on a couple of groups in Genesee County, the Sheriff's Office and the Genesee Health System, the local community mental health treatment provider. Describe the parameters of your study and how will you work with those two groups?
Sure. So I actually have, we have collaborators on the study, both from the Genesee County Sheriff's Office and from Genesee Health System, who is our community mental health center here. There's two different ways. So the first is that we want to make this treatment work in the real world. We want to make the study as informative to real world practice as we possibly can. So, you know, the sheriff's office and the community mental health system are our reality checks, so to speak. You know, they'll advise us and gives us tips on, you know, this would absolutely work in the real world, this would absolutely not work in the real world. But on a day-to-day basis, you know, we'll be recruiting people from the jail. We'll be in and out of the jail, you know, almost every day. And community mental health is a system that, you know, if folks get connected to treatment, that's often where they go. And so we'll use Genesee health system providers to moonlight for our study, the clinicians, to go into the jail and then follow up with folks after release. And, you know, that's the partnership that a lot of municipalities are trying to put together between community mental health and the jail, because everybody realizes this is a problem. They realize they need better connection to treatment, but it's just logistically sometimes challenging to make those jail community mental health partnerships smooth.
We're talking with Dr. Jennifer Johnson. She's a C.S. Mott Endowed Professor of Public Health with the Michigan State University College of Human Medicine in Flint. She's leading a study aimed at preventing suicides among recently released jail detainees. How will you track behavior once a person is released from jail during your study?
Sure. So our study, my research assistants will be calling participants and following them up to a year after release, at 1 month, 4 months, 8 months, and 12 months after release. We'll ask about suicidal thoughts, suicidal plans, any suicide attempts, hospitalizations. We're also tracking both the cost of the intervention and cost savings to the overall health system because, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you want to look at it, cost and cost effectiveness drives a lot of decisions about healthcare and the justice system. And, you know, if anyone at any of those times is considered really to be an emergency situation, to be an imminent risk, we'll refer them for emergency care.
How often do people tell the truth in something like this?
You know, so in the community, often. You know, you'd be surprised. We, in some of my studies, we ask people about drugs, we ask them about suicide, we ask them about mental health, we ask them about risky sexual behavior. And for the most part, if when you emphasize that what they're telling you is completely confidential and that you have no judgment about any of it, you're just trying to understand, people will, by and large, tell you the truth. In the jail, it's more complicated because in prisons and jails, they can get put on suicide watch, and folks who are savvy to the system sometimes will deny suicidal thoughts because they don't want to be on suicide watch. But out in the community, by and large, folks are straightforward.
It feels to me like this stigma surrounding mental health is lightening up a little bit. Is that your assessment?
I think it is. You know, it's, I think as a psychologist, I get caught off guard because to me, it's not stigmatizing at all. You know, I'm just so past that. So in a way, I think it's hard for me to judge that because sometimes I still get caught off guard by stigma because I don't think that way.
We're too close to it, right?
Yeah, I'm mm-hmm. too close. I just don't. It's like a doctor judging someone for having diabetes. I just don't even think of it. But I think that, you know, in some communities it is more than others, and particularly in minority communities, I think there is still some stigma, which is unfortunate because sometimes it keeps folks from getting help.
Well, clinical depression is in our family's gene pool, and I remember 20 years ago, that was just something you didn't talk about at all. If you did, it was in a quiet room with your psychologist. But nowadays, and maybe it's just because I live and work on a campus, it seems like so many more people are talking about it and getting help.
I think that's true. Actually, when you said that, I had a flashback to childhood of someone in the family that had a mental health problem and how hush-hush it was, and our parents didn't want us to tell anyone. And nowadays, yeah, it doesn't seem to be quite so much like that.
Dr. Jennifer Johnson is our guest. She is a C.S. Mott Endowed Professor of Public Health with the Michigan State University College of Human Medicine in Flint, and she's leading a study aimed at preventing suicides among recently released jail detainees. A key part of your research involves use of what's loosely called a safety plan. What is that, and how does it work?
Sure. So, you know, interesting things happen to people's thinking when they become suicidal. One of the things that often happens is when people are very depressed or very, very suicidal in crises, they stop being able to see other options, and almost all they can see or the only option they can see is to die. So what the safety plan does, it's kind of common sense, but it's not common sense when you're in that place. The counselor will come in, talk with the person, find out, you know, what got them to the place that they are right now, what are their triggers for feeling especially suicidal, and then make a written plan for what can you do when you feel this way. And it could be things like call somebody. Okay, who could you call? You know, who are your friends who are positive, suicide hotline. Also, if somebody has made plans for suicide, they can do things to make those plans more difficult to carry out. If you have a gun in your house, you can give it to a friend for a few months. If your plan was involved a vehicle, you can, you know, late at night, you can avoid driving late at night or have somebody come with you. If there's a particular time of day or something that's troubling, you can have someone sit with you. The safety plan also goes over, you know, okay, do you need treatment? In general, the answer is yes. How can we help connect you to services? Are there calming techniques you can use on your own, like going for a walk or doing something you enjoy? And it's a pretty simple, common sense sort of approach to just keep the person alive through those difficult times, and in the meantime, try to get them hooked in with the other services that they need.
Great advice for all of us. Dr. Jennifer Johnson is a clinical psychologist at C.S. Mott, Endowed Professor of Public Health with Michigan State University's College of Human Medicine in Flint. Dr. Johnson, thanks so much for talking with us, and best of luck with your research.
All right, thank you so much for having me on the show.
My pleasure. You're listening to Current State. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association, sitting in for Mark Bayshore. The two things that you can be sure about in life, said Benjamin Franklin, are death and taxes. But while most of us are happy to gripe about the IRS come tax season, death is still a taboo subject of conversation in many circles. A new podcast created by a group of Michigan State alums is doing its part to change that. The Looncast is exploring our beliefs surrounding death and the afterlife through storytelling. Here to talk with us are two of the co-producers, Philip Russell and Ben Thorpe. Gentlemen, welcome to the Current State.
Hey, hi. Thanks for having us.
Ben, tell us a little bit about what the Looncast is and who's behind it.
So the Looncast is this podcast, and it's four of us. We've got Phil, myself, and then Evan and Shira are our two other members. And we kind of just got to this kind of thing just fell together. We decided that, hey, we want to find ways to talk about these subjects, be it belief or death, because they don't get a lot of, we don't talk about these things. These aren't things that we discuss in our daily lives, but they're things that we all think about and all have to think about. And so how do we find, you know, ways to do that?
Where did the name come from?
I'm going to let Loon Phil take that one.
That was yours.
The name is a little bit of an enigma, I'd say. You know, the loon is kind of an important bird in Michigan, the state. But we also thought, you know, there's kind of a imagery of the lunar and like the moon that we kind of explore and night. And also kind of we're a little bit of lunatics. So kind of some puns thrown in there as well. But it's, I don't know, it's kind of an enigma about where exactly it came from, but it seems to be working. So.
And it tweets really well, doesn't
it? Yeah, it really does. Yeah.
The first season focuses on death, belief, and the supernatural. Why did you choose those topics, Phil?
That's an interesting question. I think that Ben and I, we originally this had this whole idea of wanting to go to haunted places and exploring kind of ghosts and kind of the afterlife and things like that. But once Evan and Shira kind of came onto the project, they were able to kind of focus our ideas more. And we started thinking about death and how hard it is to talk about death and the United States climate right now. And we just kind of wanted to open that up. I think it's something that everybody has to deal with in their life. And we wanted to be able to make it a little bit easier for people.
Ben, why at your age, if you don't mind me stereotyping your demographic, that's not a subject we talk about so much. Why did you guys decide this is so important?
Well, you know, I think it's not just death, it's belief. And it's why can't we talk about belief plays such a role in our lives, and it really affects, I guess for me, I think it affects the way that we live and the way that we, you know, the way that we see the world and the way that we interact with people. But we don't talk about it, right? We don't talk about, you know, how these things affect us. And so we really wanted to zero in on, you know, where does belief come from and what is it doing for us? And, you know, are there ways that we use it that are unhelpful and unhealthy? Are there ways that, you know, it helps us to have better lives? And where's the line there? And so I think we really just wanted to pick apart all of these different, you know, ideas surrounding belief. And I think particularly, you know, death, what happens after, because that's where our beliefs become the strongest, right? And the most ingrained. And so that's where we really wanted to kind of parse out, you know, where are these things and why do we have them?
You brought us a clip from the program. Set it up for us.
Okay.
What are we going to hear?
And I'll throw this over to Phil in a sec. But this is just a clip from our second episode, Echoes, which is a haunted house. It involves a haunted house in Omaha, Nebraska, that a theater troupe performed a version of Hamlet in.
Yeah, and I guess we kind of highlighted it because it kind of explores the whole idea of you can go to this play numerous days and see it from a bunch of different characters' perspectives that and kind of see how the deaths unfold. And we kind of thought that was kind of a big anxiety with people. Like, you can't never know all the answers. So we thought it was kind of cool to be in a production where you can, and you can go back and kind of figure out the whole mystery.
Let's hear the clip.
So it's the 1920s. And you're in a Victorian mansion.
You walk in through a side door and wait in a sort of small kitchen and in a small sitting area.
Everyone around you is wearing a mask.
Music sort of changes to feeling much more of the era. A woman walks in, lays the premise for the house's existence, and that being a gathering of people has come together to perform a seance, because in this house, this was the site of foul and unnatural acts.
A selection from the Looncast Echoes episode feels very much like This American Life, Phil.
Well, thank you.
What did we just hear?
So that's kind of in the beginning of the episode where we're kind of setting up this whole haunted house vibe, and the two creators of it are kind of giving us a little look about what to expect when you're entering the house.
Ben Thorpe is an MSU alumnus in the College of Communication Arts and Letters. We're talking about the Looncast, a new podcast that he's exploring with the subjects of death and the belief in the supernatural through storytelling. We're also joined by fellow producer Phil Russell. Ben, when you collect these stories, you traveled a lot. How did you decide where you wanted to go?
Yeah, so mostly we set up interviews ahead of time and said, okay, where are places that we can lock down interviews? And then started to map out, you know, where we were going to go based on that. And then a lot of, you know, I think some of the stronger interviews that we got were spontaneous, were things that we just, you know, we met people randomly, or people saw our cars really decked out in stickers with Looncast stickers and death belief in the supernatural. And so we would go some places and people would be like, hey, you know, what is that? And we'd be like, okay, this is the podcast. And they'd be like, boy, do I have a story for you. And I think a lot of the stronger stories that we got came from just that, just random people on the street.
Anybody feel freaked out by the notion when you brought it up to them?
Surprisingly not. I think more people than not were interested. You know, when we were in Dallas, Texas, as Ben was saying, we have these death belief in the supernatural sticker on the back of the car. And Evan was getting something out of the car, and it's, you know, night, maybe 11 at night. This guy walks up to him and he says, death belief in the supernatural. Well, you should talk to my wife. She's a necromancer, and she says she can speak to the dead. And, you know, this guy ends up living down the street, you know, in one of the adjacent apartment buildings. And we talked to her, and, you know, that was pretty wild.
Are there any other moments or conversations that really stick out in your mind from this first season as particularly unique?
When we were in the Seattle, we went to the University of Washington, and as Ben was saying, we usually have interviews set up, but when we went there, we didn't have anything. So we thought, instead of wasting the day doing nothing, let's try just knocking on professors' doors and trying to find somebody. So we ended up in the philosophy building, and we just walked into this philosopher's office, and he just starts expounding upon literally everything we want to know without any kind of prompt or anything. And I think that was really wild.
So you think the supernatural is assisting you in this project?
I hope
revealing
so.
People to
I hope so.
Ben Thorpe, how are you paying for all this?
We did a crowdfunding thing before we went on the road. So it was mostly just like Indiegogo. Indiegogo. And mostly we paid for the entire trip just based on that Indiegogo and then couch surfing. And we had friends kind of throughout the road that we stayed with on their couches. So mostly that's how we did it.
What was your pitch? Because I know those things that the first paragraph is the magic. What did you say?
Oh, God, I don't even remember.
We made like a really cute video. It had Evan's.
It had a little guinea pig
guinea
in
pig
it.
In
and it.
It
was like, oh, this is a cute guinea pig. You should give us money. And that may have been it.
Sometimes you just never know what kind of stuff takes
off. It works is all I know.
Phil, what do you hope listeners will get out of your podcast?
I hope that it makes they can have conversations about death or belief, religion, whatever it may be. And I hope it kind of brings them out of their current comfort zones. I think it's really easy to kind of, you know, say, I believe in this. And then you go through your whole life thinking that. I'd like this experience to kind of give people like a chance to, you know, second guess their thoughts and kind of have conversations with other people to, you know, help them bring to new conclusions.
Ben, the Looncast is going to be here at MSU for a live show this evening. What can you tell us about that?
Okay, so the theme of our live show is true in the way that it needs to be. And we put together this live show with some of the stronger interviews that we got from this. There's a dog psychic, so a woman that will speak to dead people's pets. There's a guy who falls in love with someone while on drugs. And there's a fellow that goes to a live exorcism. And so these three stories we mapped out because they mess with this theme of things feeling real and giving us something, even though they aren't necessarily true. And so what is that experience that gives us something and feels like it's substantial, but it's not real. It's not real in a factual way or a scientific way. What do we make of these experiences? And so we put together a show that messes with those themes.
We've been talking about the Looncast, a new podcast produced by MSU alums that's exploring death and the beliefs about it through storytelling. I want to thank our guests, co-producers Phil Russell and Ben Thorpe. Great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much, Scott.
Coming up on Current State, NASA announced this week that it's found liquid water on Mars. The news has scientists across the world buzzing with excitement. We check in with Abrams Planetarium Director Shannon Schmoll about what this means for the future of space exploration and the possibility of life on other planets. Plus, food, water, and shelter are basic needs, but for many in our community, so are diapers. Our Neighbors in Action spotlight this week falls on local nonprofit Mid-Michigan Diaper Bank, which is working to distribute diapers to the greater Lansing area. And linebacker Riley Bulla is a rising star on the MSU football team, but football isn't his only passion. Current State Scott's Poll talks with Bulla about his country music dreams. All that's coming up after a break. The program is Current State. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association, sitting in for Mark Bayshore. From Greek mythology to alien invasions in the War of the Worlds, Mars has always held a special place in the human imagination. And while we haven't found any little green people wandering around, NASA did announce some pretty exciting news about the red planet this week. The space agency has confirmed the presence of liquid water on the planet, something that scientists once thought was impossible. Here to talk with us about what this new discovery means for the future of space exploration is Shannon Schmoll, director of the Abrams Planetarium here on campus. You know, when my kids were little, we went there all the time. Abrams is just a fantastic place.
And thank you.
What you look young enough to have not been doing this very long. How did you decide to become a planetarium director?
I love teaching. I went to grad school to be an astronomer and partway through realized that what I really liked doing was talking to the public about astronomy and what's out there and less staring at my screen of squiggly lines. So the squiggly lines are very fun and exciting to look at and interesting. I liked teaching a little bit more, and so I ended up going a more education route. So
give us a brief kind of backstory on the history of Mars exploration.
So we've been exploring Mars, we've been looking at it up in the sky for hundreds and hundreds of years, but we started exploring it with spacecraft about 50 years ago, back in the 60s, with the Mariner spacecraft. We had the Viking spacecraft go out in the 70s. We've had several rovers that every time we send a new rover, they get bigger and bigger. So the latest one, Curiosity, is about the size of an SUV. And so we have, it's always captured our imagination. It's the one that's most likely to support any kind of life and is very close to us. And so we've been exploring it for some time now.
So what exactly did NASA find on Mars?
So they found liquid water, and it keeps on being reported as flowing. It's probably seeping more likely. And we've seen for several years, it was discovered that there are these features that come and go with Martian summer and winter. In the summer, they're there, and they seem to grow and flow down hills, and then they go away in the winter. And people and scientists have thought perhaps these are related to liquid water, but they weren't sure until recently. So they were using the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, MRO, in order to get some nice high-resolution images of the surface of Mars. And they were using a spectrometer to analyze what's actually there, what chemicals are there. And they found briny salt, or briny water, which is salty water. They found these hydrolyzed salts, which means that it's salt with water molecule components in it. And so this is confirming that there's liquid water. There has to be some kind of liquid water for that to happen. Now, we don't know much more than that. We don't know how much there is, where it's coming from, but there's at least liquid water there now.
Well, that was going to be my next question, is where do they think it's coming from? Do they have any conjecture?
I believe possibilities are there might be an aquifer underground, or there's ice underground in the surface of Mars, and so it could be coming from that. It could be coming from the atmosphere. We're not sure, and so that's sort of the next steps is everyone needs to figure out where is it coming from? How much is there?
Our special guest is Shannon Schmoll. She directs Abrams Planetarium here on campus. How important is this discovery?
Pretty important. It's pretty exciting. We thought for a long time that liquid water used to flow on Mars, but it's not. It couldn't exist there anymore. The temperature and pressure doesn't allow it. But now we have found that. And this is really important because if you, one, want to look for life, you go to the water. That's sort of the NASA motto, follow the water if you're going to try to find life. We don't know if this water can support life. We don't know if there's life there. We're not saying that there is. But if we're going to look, this is a good place to start.
What would be the next steps now that we know this? How would this change our exploration in the future?
Well, I think it means we actually have to be a little more careful. In some ways, if we were to send more rovers or people out to Mars, a human exploration of Mars to actually explore the planet further, currently things are not sanitized well enough that if, say, a microbe from Earth hopped a ride to Mars and then got into the water, there's a potential to contaminate the planet. And that's not something we want to do. We want to be able to understand Mars as Mars is. And so we have to be a little more careful with our exploration. But it also means that we have some sites that we're really interested in studying further now.
All-time favorite space travel movie, what is it?
Oh.
I imagine you're first in line for all of them, right?
Not lately. I don't get to go to many movies. I have a toddler at home, but let me think. Probably Star Wars. You have to always go back to Star Wars. It's not really space exploration, yeah, but there's lots of fun space stuff in there.
So I think about the Jodie Foster film. I think about the Matthew McConaughey thing. And most recently, the Matt Damon movie, The Martian.
Mm-hmm.
From what you know about that, how realistic of a portrayal do you think that is?
The Matt Damon movie?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know a whole lot about that one, actually.
It's interesting because he actually does try and grow things on the planet, and he's thought to be lost, and then they realize he isn't. They try and come rescue him. Is that stuff still the province of imagination, or do you see that as something that could probably happen in the future?
I think it's certainly possible for space exploration. I think we're getting closer to sending humans out to Mars. It's something that's on the to-do list, I guess, for NASA. And NASA does a lot of experiments to understand how we can grow things in space and potentially on Mars. There are experiments trying to understand best ways of actually growing things and sustaining life on other planets. And so
budget issues certainly drive this. What's your sense about how that will either speed up or slow down the process?
Budget is always an issue with NASA, and budgets seem to be cut quite frequently. I'm hoping that things like this will sort of renew that interest and push us toward more exploration. And I think we have certain companies like SpaceX that are trying to build rockets and do more privatization of space exploration, and that might be helpful. Though I think I'm hoping that this will push things towards, but I'm not sure where we're going to go with that. It's hard to say.
Yeah, is your sense that it's going to be a privatized future at some point? Is Richard Branson going to be like the first guy to make it happen?
Potentially. I think privatization will probably play a big role in our future at space exploration. And with budgets being the way they are, will probably be necessary if we want to. But I also am hopeful that we don't cut the budget to NASA and the more public funding of this, because NASA has done some wonderful things. When we do explore space and push our limits this way, NASA comes up with technologies that help us back on Earth. So we shouldn't forget that just because we're pushing ourselves out into space and exploring those limits, there is use back on Earth. So,
best iPhone and Android app for astronomy. Do you have any favorites that you like to use? And the reason I bring that up was because I was at LS Techo over the weekend, and mm-hmm. One of my friends whipped out his smartphone and he says, check this out. And he pointed it at the sky and all the stars were there. I'd never seen anything like that before.
Yeah, there's a bunch of apps like that, and I've played around with a lot of them. Though I think for me, my favorite one is actually weather apps, because that can tell me what the forecast is. There's one called the Clear Dark Sky Clock, or chart now. It's now the chart. And it tells me exactly what the observing conditions are, and so I know exactly if I can go outside and see Mars or not. So,
how and when can people come to Abrams Planetarium?
Well, we're open during the day from 8:30 to noon, and then 1 to 4:30 for our lobby and blacklight gallery. We have public shows on the weekends, so you can come check that out. We'll show you what planets are up and when you can see Mars. And tomorrow morning, if you want to get up at about 6:15 and come out, we'll have someone out front who wants to show people Mars. So Mars will be up in the morning skies right now. So.
And did you see the blood moon, or were there clouds at your place?
No, it cleared up. We were down at the Abrams Planetarium. We had probably close to 200 people come through that night, and it cleared up just in time, just before total eclipse, and cleared up, clouded back over after deepest eclipse. So we got a good view.
Shannon Schmoll is director of the Abrams Planetarium at Michigan State University. We've been talking about what liquid water on Mars means for the future of space exploration. Shannon, it's been great. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks.
Current State. I'm Scott Westerman, sitting in for Mark Bayshore. Every Wednesday on the program, we bring you Neighbors in Action, a look at an area organization working to make Greater Lansing a better place. Believe it or not, this is Diaper Needs Awareness Week. So what better time than now to discuss the diaper needs of mid-Michigan families? Mid-Michigan Diaper Bank is a nonprofit that works to provide a reliable and adequate supply of free disposable diapers and incontinence supplies to families in need in Ingham, Eaton, and Clinton, and Shiawassee and Ionia counties, a broad swath. They work primarily with agencies who distribute the diapers to those in need. With us today are Teresa Walls, Executive Director of the Mid-Michigan Diaper Bank, and Annie Olson, Community Health Worker at the Pathways to Better Health organization, which is a program of the Ingham County Health Department. Welcome to Turin State, guys.
Good morning.
Teresa, what exactly does the Diaper Bank do?
Well, what we do is we try to fill the gap between assistance by providing a reliable and consistent supply of diapers to families in need and adult briefs to adult children in the Greater Lansing area through our community agencies that we partner with.
It's been a long time since we've had toddlers, but we do have a grandson, and he runs through a lot of diapers. What is the cost to put a kid in diapers for a year?
Well, typically it runs, you know, they go through 8 diaper changes a day, so it comes to about $80 per month, so.
It's a cable bill.
Yeah, exactly. And so we try to alleviate that expense, sorry.
And babies aren't the only ones who need diapers. Annie, you work with some of these adults in need. Tell us more about what you do as a community health worker with the Pathways to Better Health team.
Well, I'm a community health worker with Pathways to Better Health, which is a program that the Michigan Public Institute, in partnership with the Michigan Department of Community Health, partnered with several different agencies, including the Ingham County Health Department. And they deploy community health workers into the community to work with adults over the age of 18 who have 2 or more chronic health conditions and are eligible for either Medicaid or Medicare. We do have clients who have financial need and have health issues, and this helps to fill a gap for those people as well. If you can imagine trying to choose between serving food, having a bus token, you know, your personal care supplies like shampoo and cream rinse and things of that nature, and you're off, you know, weighing that out against purchasing some adult briefs and incontinence supplies, that can be a tough choice. And if people don't have those supplies, they can become isolated, and that can lead to depression and other kinds of things. So most people wouldn't necessarily think about these as being that important, but they really are.
And how did you find out about the Mid-Michigan Diaper Bank?
Well, as community health workers, our job is to be aware of the different resources in the community that we can connect these clients to. And Teresa Love, I came into contact with her, and we spread the news amongst our group as to what's available in the community. So we have a lot of different workers that are accessing the supplies.
We have, Teresa, is it Love or Walls? What is your last name?
Walls.
Okay, I was confused there for a moment.
I'm sorry.
Teresa is the executive director of the Mid-Michigan Diaper Bank, and Annie Olson, a community health worker with Pathways to Better Health. We're speaking about the diaper needs of Michigan families and individuals. Teresa, I'm always fascinated by what makes people choose their careers. What brought you here?
Well, I was volunteering at a maternity home, and, you know, as taking care of the babies, I realized the great need for diapers at this agency, you know, a group of babies used during the week. And so I took it upon myself to just try to look for some source to alleviate that agency with this exorbitant expense. And in my search, I discovered that many agencies in our area are challenged with keeping diapers on their shelves for families in need. And also I discovered diaper banks popping up all over the nation, and knowing that we did not have one in our community, I just felt the calling to start one, you know, in our community for people in need.
So you're an entrepreneur. You actually brought this thing up from the ground.
Yes.
Yeah. How did you do that? It's not really easy to just go from point A to point B. What were some of the challenges?
Stepping out, yeah. Like this was definitely out of my comfort zone, speaking to people about things like this. But eventually we visited the National Diaper Bank Network and, you know, met a lot of great people who have the same desire to help people with this need that does not receive, you know, the families don't receive help for diapers. No, they cannot use their WIC or food stamps, and many adults cannot use their insurance. You know, insurance companies do not cover incontinence supplies. So, you know, taking the plunge after, you know, being encouraged by them, and then, you know, applying for all the nonprofit status, all the lovely paperwork. So here we are.
Did you ever think that you would be an entrepreneur like this?
No, not at all.
Where opportunity meets preparation. Annie, what has the response to MidMichigan Diaper Bank been from the Ingham County Health Department Pathways to Better Health?
Everybody is extremely grateful for the resources that are offered in our community. Probably our largest responsibility to our clients is to get them connected to the things that they need. We also provide some health education around the chronic health conditions that they have. But the response has really been great. I know that there's been several of our workers right at the health department that have called and accessed for their clients.
Any particular story that stands out in your mind about how you've made a difference in someone's life?
Absolutely. I did have a young woman. She was not an elderly woman by any means, and had suffered a surgical accident that rendered her having some pretty severe problems with incontinence. And she was homeless at the time and was purchasing a very, very small quantity at one time, which was very expensive, of the adult briefs, only what she could carry in her backpack at the time. So once we were able to meet a lot of her immediate needs, including housing, we did get her connected with the diaper bank and was able to bring not only the adult briefs for her, but some other supplies as well that caused her supplies to last a little bit longer. She has just been so grateful for what she's been receiving. And then we're working on building up her confidence again in the medical arena to have the courage to go back in and have the medical repair necessary. But in the meantime, this is really building her faith in the people around her that care for her. And I know it's been a combination of things, but she's smiling again, and she wasn't smiling for the first several months that I saw her. So it's really exciting to see the change that something like this can make in someone's life.
Teresa, back in the day when our kids were babies, cloth diapers were an option. Is that still done?
Oh, yes. We don't, you know, people do use cloth diapers, and, you know, it seems like they're growing a surge. And, but unfortunately for some families, like some of our agencies are actually shelters that house more than, you know, half a dozen or, you know, 12, 20 babies at a time. They're not going to use cloth diapers in their facilities. And many families who utilize daycare services have to supply a full supply of diapers, and not very many daycare centers in our area allow children to come in with cloth diapers. And it's very challenging for families when they do not have, you know, personal washing facilities, you know, to, you know, not being able to launder their own diapers as well.
Which is more sustainable, cloth or disposable?
Well, there's a hot debate about that.
Okay, I've asked the key question, right?
Yeah.
This depends on who you're talking to.
Yeah.
From your perspective, do you have a preference?
Well, I think the best diaper is the clean diaper. And if you can do cloth, you know, I definitely, you know, propose to do that. But, you know, it's a struggle for some who
and
lack.
Don't have the infrastructure. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
We've been speaking with Executive Director of MidMichigan Diaper Bank, Teresa Walsh, and Annie Olson, a community health worker with Pathways to Better Health. Teresa and Annie, thank you so much for joining us on Current State today.
Thank you.
Current State is looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Please help us out and email us your suggestions to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line or tweet us at KAR Current State and tell us a little bit about why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. One of the rising stars of the MSU football team is junior linebacker Riley Bulla. His football pedigree is well known. His grandfather, Henry, played at MSU in the 50s. His father, Shane, was a Spartan in the 80s. His brother, Max, was here through the 2013 season. And another brother, Byron, is a redshirt freshman at MSU. Beyond that, his other grandfather, Jim Morse, played at Notre Dame. And three uncles also played college football. On New Year's Day, after MSU had overcome a 20-point deficit to Baylor in the Cotton Bowl to take the one-point lead that took us home, Riley Bulla ended Baylor's hopes of retaking that lead with a late-game interception. George Blaha made the call on the Spartan Sports Network.
Baylor with one timeout left. Third and 23 for Bryce Petty. Steps back inside his five. Throws it in the middle. It's intercepted. It's intercepted by Riley Bulla. It's all over.
I was there, and I got to tell you, there were tears in my eyes. Last spring, Current State's Scott Pohl talked with Riley Bulla about his other passion, music. With football season underway now, we thought it would be good to revisit that conversation, hear a bit of his music in action.
I don't think a lot of fans are familiar, Riley Bulla, with the fact that you have a strong interest in music. So I'd like to know more about that. What kind of music appeals to you? What do you like to perform?
Yeah, as of recently, it's been a lot of country music, more on that side. But, you know, it hasn't always been that way. Growing up, I was into a lot of rock, you know, alternative stuff. But, you know, I'm just a fan of music in general. I listen to it all. I listen to electronic, you know, hip-hop, mostly country now. But, you know, it's been all over the spectrum. But as of recently, it's been more country music.
Do you write music?
I do write music. Yeah, I think that's one of my biggest things I love to do with music is, you know, write my own songs. I don't like playing other people's music as much, but I do it now as of recently. But, you know, just songwriting is something I've done as long as I can remember, dating back to middle school. So, you know, it's something I've carried on through college and something I still do today.
When you write music, what kind of inspires you? What thematically, what do you write songs about?
You know, it's different. You know, a lot of the times, depending on how I'm feeling or, you know, what's going on in my life. Sometimes it's about personal things. Sometimes it's about things in general. Maybe I just want to write a song that makes people feel happy and, you know, something like that. Maybe like a summer song or something like that. So it's different every time. But, you know, it's really what you're in the mood, what kind of mood you're in is what kind of song you're going to write in the end. So that's kind of how it's been with me.
Do you get to perform in public much?
You know, sometimes. I got to a few times last summer. But, you know, as of recently, it's hard because I'm busy all the time. It's something I love to do and I enjoy. And it's just a great release from football sometime to have something else to, you know, lean back on and do for fun instead of football.
Riley Bulla, you've put some of your music online that people can hear, and so we're going to hear some music. Can you tell me something about the song we'll hear?
Yeah, it's a song by Cole Swindell. He's one of my favorite artists. I've been following him for a couple years. And the song is called Ain't Worth the Whiskey. So this is probably just my favorite song that I've been able to cover by him. So here it is.
I'll drink to a country song, to another long work week gone, and I'll raise my glass to a long lost buddy I ain't seen. Might stay for one more round, or I might close this place down. Don't think for a second I'm out to drown your memory, honey. You ain't worth the whiskey.
I think people will be curious to know about your ambitions in music. Is it a career ambition?
You know, at this point, I don't necessarily think performing will be something I look at for my career. But I want to be working in music somehow. I'm not really sure yet. I've been getting into radio more, so that's something that interests me right now. You know, as I progress through college, my interests are changing. So, you know, we'll see, you know, what happens come the next 2 years or so.
Do you think of yourself as a football player who happens to be a musician or a musician who happens to be a football player?
Well, since I play at Michigan State under scholarship, I got to think I'm a football player first, and I got to keep my attention there. But, you know, I've always loved music my whole life. People outside looking in may think of me as a football player who plays music. My family might think it's different. You know, I might think it's a little different, but it's all your perception. But, you know, in the end, I love football and I love music, so that's really what it's about.
What's your major?
I am media and information.
Riley Bulla from the MSU football program. Thank you so much and good luck.
Thanks for having me.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, football season is a time to sport your favorite team's colors and cheer on the players from the stands. But for many college students, it's also a time to drink what can be a dangerous amount of alcohol. We'll talk with Bridge Magazine reporter Ron French about his recent reporting on binge drinking and sports culture at the Michigan colleges. Plus, each of us has to deal with the struggles of getting older. And a play coming to Ann Arbor explores one woman seemingly over her head in dealing with her aging mother. We'll speak with the director and the star of Assisted Living. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks also to Mark Bayshore. Drew Hill is spinning the dials in there for me. We're also grateful to Melissa Benmark, April Van Buren, Jamie Paisley, and Katie Cook. Get Current State delivered straight to your smartphone every morning. Just subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us on social media. We're at KAR Current State on Twitter and on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association, filling in for Mark Bayshore, and you've been listening to Current State on WKAR.